There was a question in the discussion last time, which was appropriately asked by a philosopher, that leads us straight into tonight's topic. The question was something like this: seeing that Kierkegaard held such terrible views, why should one study him? Now you may think, seeing that tonight's topic is Nietzsche and the crisis in philosophy, that I think that this question is very applicable to Nietzsche. I don't think so particularly. I don't think that his views, for the most part, were so terrible, though a few of them perhaps were. My point is that this question points straight toward the crisis in philosophy. Last week, when I spoke about Kierkegaard and the crisis in religion, I suggested that there were two factors in particular that accounted for the crisis in religion. One of those was a fairly obvious one in the case of religion, namely the emergence of scientific thinking, which has produced great problems for religion. The other factor was a more nearly timeless factor, namely organized religion poses a problem for the genuine religious spirit. I shall try to pursue both of these factors now in relation to philosophy and begin this lecture by talking about the crisis in philosophy before introducing Nietzsche. I do think that the first and chief factor of what I consider the crisis in contemporary philosophy has also been introduced by science. After all, if I understand the question rightly, it does show a considerable regard, which is very widely, if not quite universally, shared in our society, a very profound respect for science. In science, we don't study terrible views. In science, we don't deal with people of whom we think that they are clearly wrong. Philosophers today do, on the whole, want to be scientific. They want to emulate the sciences, not for any cheap motives, not because they want to have the same sort of prestige that scientists have, but for the best of motives. Science has made enormous progress for several centuries now, and incredible progress in the lifetime of most of us, and so one wonders whether philosophy could possibly do better than to imitate science. Now, where is there a crisis here? Here I think philosophers are one up on the theologians. It's perhaps one of the few areas where their one-upmanship exceeds that of the theologians. And what the theologians would admit, I think, to be a crisis in philosophy, the philosophers call a revolution in philosophy, and that, in spite of the Un-American Activities Committee, sounds rather good. A revolution in philosophy suggests progress in philosophy and something that we need not worry about. But there is a crisis in philosophy here. One way I think that I can illustrate it is with a story of which I'm not at all sure whether it is true, although I've heard it from many sides. I shall therefore not name the philosopher in question about whom this story is often told. The point is that he is an outstanding logical positivist and that he supposedly was offered a chair of philosophy at one of our leading universities and did not accept the last minute because supposedly, and this is hard to credit, one of the requirements was that he should, among other things, teach an introductory course on Plato, and he is supposed to have replied, "I will teach only the truth." Now here you have, I think, the same point that I've been dealing with. Why teach terrible views? And Plato did have some views that few of us would accept, even some views in political philosophy that many of us might consider terrible. And here now is the crisis. If a philosopher wants to be scientific, if he does not want to teach things that are not true, if he most certainly does not want to teach things that are terrible, what becomes of practically all the philosophy we have got? What becomes of philosophy from the pre-Socratics and Plato and Aristotle right down to the 20th century? Should it all be rejected? Well, if so, then surely we have reached a crisis in philosophy, if philosophers have reached the point where they think that all philosophy so far, or at least most of it, almost all of it, has been one huge mistake. The question immediately arises, of course, if you throw out so very, very much, what is to replace it? The early logical positivists thought that they had a good criterion for telling what could stay and what could not stay. Only that was supposed to stay, only that was recognized as meaningful, which could be verified, and whatever was not verifiable was meaningless, as one supposed in those days, shortly after World War I, and was to be eliminated. And what was left, in fact, was something very different from most of traditional philosophy. Things like philosophy of religion and metaphysics and aesthetics, all that went out the window, and good work was done, important work was done, in areas like philosophy of science and logic, especially in those two fields. Ludwig Wittgenstein, who had done as much as any man to inspire logical positivism, drew the really consistent conclusion at that point. After publishing his first book, the so-called Tractatus, in which he thought that he had solved all philosophic problems by showing that most of them were meaningless, he left philosophy. He was a very wonderful man. He had inherited great wealth. He distributed all among the poor and became a village teacher and then a gardener's assistant. And then as more and more people accepted his book and his early views, he decided that something must be wrong with them. And so he went back to philosophy, to a second very illustrious career, becoming a professor, though Austrian-born, becoming a professor at the University of Cambridge in England and influencing the second phase of positivism, which is more usually called analytic philosophy, and which today dominates English-speaking philosophy, both in the British Isles, particularly in England, less so in Scotland, and in the United States too. This has been characterized in a little book on English philosophy since 1900 by Geoffrey Warnock, when he says, and what he says here is false, unless we keep in mind that he is talking about English philosophy since 1900. He says, it is at any rate certain that questions of belief, questions of religious, moral, political, or generally cosmic variety, cosmic he puts into sneer quotes, are seldom, if at all, directly dealt with in contemporary philosophy. Why is this so? The first part of an answer to this question can easily be given. There's a very large number of questions, not of that variety, which philosophers find themselves more interested in discussing. I think, as far as English-speaking philosophy goes, this is a pardonable generalization. There's a great deal of truth in it, even though it isn't literally correct. And if we ask ourselves now, why this shift of interest? It doesn't seem to be true of society generally that it is no longer interested in questions of religious, moral, political variety. People are quite interested in those. Why aren't philosophers interested in them anymore? I think the answer, the chief answer, answer number one at any rate, is they want to be scientific. They want to obtain agreement on facts. They are embarrassed by disagreement among philosophers, and they despair, sensibly, of obtaining agreement on questions of religious, moral, political, and cosmic variety. So it is the attempt to emulate the sciences that has in one way or another led the vast majority of English-speaking philosophers to abandon the traditional concerns of philosophers and to make a great shift. There are other reasons here which lead me to the second factor, but let me begin by still subsuming them under the attempt to emulate the sciences. One feels that everybody should be able to make some contribution, that the progress in the sciences is made piecemeal by many people doing little things, and so in philosophy too there should be a comparable situation. And when one of the outstanding living English philosophers, Gilbert Ryle, suggests that the analysis of what he calls systematically misleading expressions, and I quote an early essay of his, is what philosophical analysis is, and this is the sole and whole function of philosophy, he is motivated partly, I think, by a desire for something that can be done with precision and accuracy. He is also motivated by the desire of staking out some area in which philosophy will not conflict with science, not be shown up by the progress of science, but on the contrary, where it will be possible for many competent people to make contributions and conceivably even to engage in teamwork of a sort. To mention another equally outstanding British philosopher who died recently, J.L. Austin, he varied the interests of Ryle somewhat by concentrating very largely on things that bordered on lexicography, semantic analysis, analyzing distinctions in ordinary language, hoping that where there are subtle distinctions between words that are apparently synonymous, perhaps some important difference is hidden that might eventually become philosophically important or fruitful. But he found this kind of precise work so absorbing that he very, very rarely indeed bothered to point up its philosophic relevance. The point here is, again, to do something that can be done with precision, to do something that does not involve inspiration but competence, in other words, to emulate the sciences. Now I have said that the other factor, the factor of organization, has also helped to produce the crisis in philosophy, and this, I think, is, if anything, even less obvious than my first point, that science poses a deep and critical problem for philosophy. After all, happily, we don't have organization in philosophy the way we do have it in religion. There's nothing at all unusual for a philosopher going it alone. Of course, there are some little clubs where people get together who happen to agree particularly with each other, but that is the exception rather than the rule. And the whole philosophy is lucky in not being beset by hierarchies and organizations and all that sort of thing. But in another sense, philosophy has become organized. Let's put the point this way. What I've been saying about philosophy relinquishing problems of religious and political and cosmic and moral variety so very largely and becoming so very preoccupied with questions of method, of science, of logic, amounts to saying that philosophy has become, in the 20th century, exceedingly academic. And if we ask why philosophy has become so terribly, terribly academic, surely a very important part of the answer is that philosophy has become academic because almost all philosophers are in academies. The organizations in question are our colleges and universities. We take it for granted that, of course, if a man says, and is in his right mind, that he is a philosopher, that presumably he means that he teaches philosophy at some college or university. But if we think back a few centuries, that of course did not use to be so. People like Descartes and Locke and Hobbes and Berkeley and Hume and Spinoza, they were not professors. They did not have university jobs. And this surely makes a big difference. It does not make all of the difference by itself. We can be more precise here. We can almost be scientific. We can quantify the point. And we can say that the really crucial point about organization is that where formerly, at any one time, in any one generation, there were maybe half a dozen, or at most a dozen philosophers, today there are quite literally many, many thousands. That's no exaggeration. All you have to do is to take some such dictionary as Webster's Collegiate, look up in the back the list of colleges. I think you will find that in the United States alone, there are over 1,000 colleges and universities, and most of them have more than one philosopher. Some of them have over 12 philosophers, which means that in the United States alone, you have thousands of philosophers. But this is an entirely new situation which is bound to change the whole tone of philosophy. The unit of publication, for example, can no longer be the book. Nobody has time to read books by thousands and thousands of philosophers. Something new has to be invented to take care of this situation, the scholarly journal. I'm not trying to make fun of this. Perhaps in some way the situation is amusing, but we have here a perfectly reasonable development. There are these thousands of people. They live spread out over a huge country. They can't constantly get together and see each other face to face and talk with each other. How are they going to make each other aware that they are alive physically, that they are alive intellectually, that they have something to say? They have to be scholarly, professional journals in which people write articles of which other people can take note. And these articles, for the most part, are written for what has been called, rightly, fellow craftsmen, fellow technicians, other people who are professionals in the field. Well, if a man like Spinoza had written just for fellow philosophers, there wouldn't have been any need to print his books. He could have circulated them in manuscript, and within 2 years, all the fellow philosophers around could easily have read them. This wasn't so just in Spinoza's time, but this was so for a long, long time while philosophy flourished. But these philosophers did not just address this minute audience of maybe 6 or 12 other philosophers, that was all there was in those days, but they addressed the layman too, and so they didn't deal just with academic points, but they dealt with questions that mattered to people generally. Well, today, most professional philosophers lean over backwards not to do that. Take a young man in his 20s who in the 18th century wrote a book with the title Treatise of Human Nature, being an attempt to introduce the experimental method of reasoning into moral subjects. His name was David Hume, and the book that he wrote was a great book, which is still studied. But what young professional philosopher in his 20s would dare write a book with a title like that and try to cover so many subjects in a single book? It so happened that Hume's book was initially not a success, but fell stillborn from the presses, as he himself put it. But in time, it had an enormous impact. Here, then, we have the contrast. And we actually find some of the professional philosophers, Warnock, for example, in his little book on English philosophy since 1900, making fun, without naming names, of the amateurs of former ages and extolling the professional philosophers of our time. I feel that the shoe is a little bit on the other foot, and that amateurs like, for example, Hume and Berkeley, who published their major works when they were still in their 20s, are not people for us to look down on. And I dare say that the reason why young philosophers today don't write books like that is not because those books were so amateurish and so bad, but rather because they were so extremely bold. Now, this is a good point, I think, to introduce the philosopher of the evening, and I will do it with a quotation that relates him immediately to what I have characterized as the crisis in philosophy. Nietzsche writes in Beyond Good and Evil, section 212, which is reprinted or translated in full in the portable Nietzsche, that traditionally the great philosopher has always stood in opposition to his today. I'm abbreviating the section. The great philosopher traditionally has stood in opposition to his today. Philosophers have been the bad conscience of their time. They knew of a new greatness of man, of a new untrodden way to his enhancement. Confronted with a world of modern ideas, which would banish everybody into a corner and a specialty, a philosopher, if there could be any philosophers today, would be forced to define the greatness of man, the concept of greatness, in terms precisely of man's comprehensiveness and multiplicity, his wholeness and manifoldness. Then Nietzsche gives some illustrations of 16th century philosophers, goes on to talk a little bit about Socrates, and continues, today, conversely, when only the herd animal is honored and dispenses honors in Europe, and when equality of rights could all too easily be converted into an equality in violating rights, by that I mean into a common war on all that is rare, strange, or privileged, on the higher man, the higher soul, the higher duty, the higher responsibility, and on the wealth of creative power and mastery, today, the concept of greatness entails being noble, wanting to be by oneself, being capable of being different, standing alone, and having to live independently. Thus, in 1886, Ludwig Wittgenstein would not only have understood, but I think would have agreed very largely. He too, by temperament, was a man who was different, stood alone, lived independently. But on the whole, certainly ordinary language philosophy, linguistic philosophy, analytic philosophy, whatever we shall call it, is not very much in sympathy with the sentiments expressed by Nietzsche here, but on the contrary, an example of what you might call counter-revolutionary philosophy, not really a revolution in philosophy. Traditionally, the philosopher has been a revolutionary, a heretic, who stood in opposition to us today. But linguistic philosophy has an influence that leads men away from trying to stand alone. It would indeed, as Nietzsche puts it, banish philosophers into a corner and a specialty. It teaches young philosophers not to become heretics, not to become revolutionaries, because it wouldn't be scientific, and they really don't have any special competence that qualifies them for that role. Nietzsche might well have said that it might be a philosopher's business, if there could be any philosophers today, to acquire such a competence. And if you should say, well, it would be terrible if we trained all our young philosophers to become revolutionaries of this sort, this would just bring intellectual chaos, the answer would be that if you decide that nobody should even try things that not everybody can do, surely that would amount to what Nietzsche calls a common war on all that is rare, strange, or privileged. on the higher man, the higher soul, the higher duty, the higher responsibility. Now here we have Nietzsche, another man who is widely considered to be a man with terrible views, even more so than Kierkegaard. Kierkegaard really isn't considered that. It was just I who, out of pure cussedness, brought out that Kierkegaard really had some views that would strike many people as terrible, some of which somehow I have take perverse pleasure in. I sort of think that they're thought-provoking, that they make us rethink things that we had taken for granted, that even where I cannot agree with him at all, I learn something from him because he makes me reflect on things that otherwise I might not have reflected on. And Nietzsche, on the other hand, because everybody thinks that he has such terrible views, I sort of swim against the stream here too, by trying to point out that his views really weren't quite so terrible, and what I just read you is a good example. Some people get their hackles up as soon as they hear Nietzsche speaking about the herd animal. This shows his being undemocratic and all that sort of thing. But if you listen once more to the words that I just read you, I wonder whether most of you wouldn't agree that what he characterizes here is precisely some of the most disgraceful things that have happened in our own democracy since World War II, namely that an equality of rights could all too easily be converted into an equality in violating rights, into a common war on all that is rare, strange, or privileged, on the higher man, the higher soul, the higher duty, the higher responsibility, and on the wealth of creative power and mastery. We've had a lot of that since World War II. But let us generalize and not engage at this point in any special pleading for Nietzsche. Let's say, all right, he did have some terrible views, like Kierkegaard, and like Plato, and like Homer, and like Dante, and like Dostoevsky, all people who are terribly worth reading and who had perfectly dreadful ideas about all sorts of things. Homer obviously took a great delight in cruelty, thought that it was terribly funny to beat up a hunchback. Dante's sense of humor was even much more gruesome than that. And if it wasn't humor, it's even worse. And in Dostoevsky's case, perhaps some of you are not aware of some of his perfectly dreadful opinions. Here then is the question, is philosophy perhaps in some sense closer to literature than to science? In literature, certainly, we don't consider it necessary for a great writer first to assure us that he has wholesome views. Is philosophy similar to that? Well, perhaps at least partly so. Perhaps there are some similarities between philosophy and poetry, philosophy and literature. Men share what Tolstoy once called a fear to understand things that clash with their own customs, privileges, or beliefs. I think we all share that fear. Some of us are a little more housebroken than others. Some of us have mastered this fear to some extent. Some of us perhaps are never conscious of this fear, but still, I think all of us find, if we are very honest with ourselves, that on occasion we don't try very hard to understand things that clash with our own customs, privileges, or beliefs. And just as it is one of the functions of literature to force us to enter into ideas, views that clash with our customs, privileges, and beliefs, so philosophers too might have this job, among others, to make men more sensitive to other points of view, to show men how an outlook that's widely slandered and despised looks and feels from inside. To that extent, a philosopher, I think, is closer to an artist, and particularly a novelist or a dramatist, than he is to a scientist. Now, there are differences, however. A novelist or a dramatist may occasionally examine an argument. He really doesn't have to. A philosopher constantly has to evaluate the arguments for and against alternative positions. And this can be quite thrilling. This can be quite interesting to do this. This is an important part of philosophy. The point that I'm making is not particularly original or revolutionary in our time. It was made long ago by Socrates in that perhaps most famous saying of his, that the unexamined life is not worth living. It's part of the function of a philosopher to lead people to examine their lives. And one way of doing that is by being provocative, by provoking people, by offering them terrible views to make them think. Wittgenstein has put this point beautifully, if only in a posthumously published letter to a younger friend and student. I'll quote it. "What is the use of studying philosophy if all that it does for you is to enable you to talk with some plausibility about some abstruse questions of logic, etc., and if it does not improve your thinking about the important questions of everyday life, if it does not make you more conscientious? I know that it's difficult to think well about certainty, probability, perception, etc., but it is, if possible, still more difficult to think or try to think really honestly about your life and other people's lives. And the trouble is that thinking about these things is often downright nasty. And when it's nasty, then it's most important.